All right. So, thank you all for coming and supporting. My name's Danny, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Danny.
We love you, Danny.
Lots and lots and lots and lots
of juice. Yeah, white paws. That's what's up. That's great. No, I just want to thank again Scott for donating and putting the time and effort to do this, and everyone else who had a part in this, Stucky Paw and UC Paw. Let's give a little round of applause. Which side announcement, UC Paw, I believe is going on in April, right?
April 7th, 8th, and 9th.
Nowhere near April.
Yeah. It's in the summer.
You know where Judd's is?
Nowhere near Judd's. Okay, well, June, and UC Paw, if you guys aren't familiar, is Utah Conference of Young People and Alcoholics Anonymous. And we need, as from what I've heard, we need support, we need funds, and so we're going to continue doing stuff like this, and if we can continue getting support, we'll have a kick-ass UC Paw next year. I'd like to take the time now. I'm going to pass the time off to the speaker tonight, and came all the way from Salt Lake. And he goes by the crazy Asian, the gay, the fabulous, awesome, the Wade. Let's give it up to him. Wade alcoholic.
Hey, Wade. We love you, Wade. Lots and lots and lots of whole bunches.
So I guess I just start from the beginning. I was born in Seoul, South Korea, left in a basket at a police station, adopted by white Mormons in Utah, and that's why I'm an alcoholic. So thank you, and have a good night, and thanks for coming out. The reason why I bring that up is because a lot of times when we hear a lot of people's drunk logs or their war stories, we hear a lot about them. And for some reason, a lot of us, including myself, when I would hear people's war stories and I'd hear their drunk logs, I saw that for me, I blamed my drunk log and I blamed my war stories and I blamed the circumstances of life for why I drank. I'm gay, I'm Asian, I'm adopted, I'm in Utah, I'm Mormon. And I used all of these reasons and these circumstances that happened to me to blame everybody else for why I drank. I was one of those people that was a very good Mormon boy. I went on a Mormon mission for about 7 months and came home early. And it's because I missed my mom. I like to tell people early on that, you know, it's because I was gay and I couldn't make that work with the church. And so that's why I came home. But I just missed my mom. And I was homesick. So I came home and then I came out of the closet. And I told everybody that I was gay. And then I found the bar. Now, one of the things about me is when I was 10 years old, I knew I was. I was the kid that was getting in trouble at the playground for playing kissing tag, but not just kissing the girls. The playground teacher would call my parents, but he's got a little problem. He's also trying to kiss the boys, and that's making some of them uncomfortable. And so I've always felt a little bit different from the very beginning, from the get-go. And one of the things that I found out is that when you enter in a certain subculture, which it could be any subculture that you participate in, you kind of mesh to that because I wanted to feel like I belonged somewhere. And so drinking was a big part of that scene. And I remember the very first house party I went to is they were drinking, and my first drink was a fuzzy navel. And then that night, it was immediate. I'm like, oh my God, that hole inside of me, that feeling of not belonging, disappeared. And I went upstairs to the loft part of the apartment, and they were all smoking weed. And I said, well, geez, that sounds like fun. But everybody knew me as Wade, the good little Mormon boy. And so they all thought they got paranoid and all thought I was a cop. And they're all, oh, we don't got no weed up here. You need to go somewhere else. And so I had to wait till the next shift. And then the next shift came, and I just sat there and waited. And I took my first hit. And, man, I was in heaven. I've never felt more at peace with myself. I grew up with that Mormon belief that homosexuality was wrong. You pray the gay away. and I prayed. And I prayed and learned about the second coming of Christ, and so I thought I was going to go to hell. And I'd had nightmares that my family would be lifted up to heaven, and I would be left on the ground reaching for them. Please don't leave me. Please don't leave me. And those are the kind of nightmares I had from 10 to about 16. And I wanted to die every day. I wanted to die. I wanted to kill myself. I would say, you know, God, this isn't going away. I've prayed. I've repented. I've done everything you've asked. Please take this away, because if you don't, you know, it won't matter. And then all of a sudden it was like okay to smoke and drink. And that filled that void for me. And drinking took on very serious proportions, to the point where my parents asked me to, you know, you can't live here anymore in our home, because our home is a sanctuary, and we can't have you doing this. And I thought, well, okay, it's your relationship with your son or your stupid rules. And they said, our rules stand. And I moved to San Diego and quickly found this scene called the rave scene. And one of the things about the rave scene, and I compare this all the time, it's like AA, but you can do drugs. Everybody loves you, everybody's accepting, you have lots of fun, you stay up all night, but you get to feel good with drugs and alcohol at the same time. And I quickly learned that if I sold them, I had a lot more money, and I could get a lot more things from other people. And I quickly learned that how to manipulate people. How could I get what I needed from you to make myself feel better? And eventually the great city of San Diego decided to do a sting operation, in which I was handily caught, and they felt it was appropriate for me to spend some time in jail. And so I spent some time in jail, and I remember calling my mom bawling, I'm in jail, I'm never going to do this again. And I sincerely meant it. I wanted out. One thing about drugs and alcohol, though, you guys, is it saved my life for a while. It worked for a while. For a while, that feeling of not belonging, that feeling of self-hatred, was taken away through drugs and alcohol for a while. Eventually started to quit working. Got out of jail, got put back in because they did a fourth waiver search. I found some stuff in my house, and I spent another week in jail, again, promising I'm never going to do it again. I was sentenced to 6 months rehab or 3 months work furlough. And something in my body told me, in my heart, said, go to rehab. So I went to rehab. And again, utilizing all the tools that I could possibly get what I wanted, I manipulated that rehab. And I took advantage of everything that I do. I would do anything that I could do to not have to do the work that they were teaching us. I'd go to the meetings because it was fun and it was a social way to get out of the rehab. And but I never did the work. I would say, well, instead of me doing this, how about I train all these guys here how to make a resume? And they bought it, and they, you know, and I was cheating myself the whole time out of this opportunity to recover. And I got a year and a half sober. And I didn't think I was an alcoholic. I was just a drug addict. I only had problems with drugs. Drugs were the problem. I'm not an alcoholic. I didn't do bad things on alcohol. And so I went back out and decided that it was okay to drink again. And then I spent the next 11 years from 2001 till 2010. So 9 years. I spent the next 9 years trying to prove myself an exception to the rule. Just like it talks about in the big book in chapter 3. I tried everything to make myself not an alcoholic. I would get 2.5 years sober in that time period, and then I'd go back out. And the thing is the overwhelming power and baffling feature of alcohol for me was that I would convince myself that I would have to control my drinking for a year. And then you would have to take your hat off to me, and then I could drink again. So for 1 year, I would go out to the bar and I would drink one or two drinks and force myself not to drink more than that, because if I did it, I was an alcoholic, and then I couldn't prove you wrong. That's how delusional I was, thinking that somehow that would be what created the situation for me not to be an alcoholic. But the problem is Alcoholics Anonymous isn't here to tell me I'm an alcoholic. That's something that I have to determine. I finally put together again 9-7 months. I go quickly through my drunk alcoholics. It's not as fun and exciting as recovery is for me, but I finally got 7 months. My sponsor, who had 4 years, was cleaning his room, found a baggie of heroin, and he decided to go back out. So I moved to Utah at that time because the economy had tanked, and I moved to Utah, and I couldn't connect with anybody in Utah. This was this excuse. Nobody in Utah likes me. I'm Asian. Everybody's white. You know, back to the old thinking, that old behavior, and I relapsed again. But the great part about that was that in 2 months, I didn't have anybody that I had to hold myself accountable to for a year. I didn't have to prove myself that I could drink like a gentleman for a year. And I learned that if you do cocaine with liquor, you can drink a hell of a lot more and not black out. But what ended up happening to me is I would black out still, but be awake from the cocaine. So I would be third person watching myself do everything that everybody told me I did in a blackout, and it was a nightmare.
Oh yeah.
It was a fucking nightmare. And and I finally realized that I walked out of work one day and I said, God, here's the deal. I've tried everything that I think I need to do to stay sober, and I'm not staying sober. I'm giving you one last chance, otherwise I'm going to kill myself, because it doesn't matter. I'm going to hell anyways, because that's what everybody has told me I'm going to. And I go, I can't live my life. I took out $1,900 in payday loans to drink in Utah, because you only get an ounce. In California, it's not measured. So it's really expensive to drink in Utah at the bar. And I looked up on my building, and I had this feeling. It said, go inside, look up a meeting, there will be one for you. And I went upstairs and got on my computer, and I looked up, and there was this meeting called Candlelight. And it was, I got off at 9:30, and the meeting was at like 10 or something like that. I said, okay, I'm going. And I sped off to, right after I got off work, and the whole time I kept telling God, God, if nobody says hi to me at this meeting, I'm never going back to AA again. And I'm going to drink myself to the bitter end. And that's how sick an alcoholic will be. You'll get the answer that I was looking for, and yet I'll still bargain with God. And I got to that meeting, and I sat behind it. It was a candlelight meeting. There's this little pole in the middle of the room. I sat behind the little pole just thinking, God, please don't let anybody come say hi to me, please. And this guy came up to me. And he says, hey, I don't recognize you. My name is so-and-so. What's your name? And that man saved my life that night. At that point in time, I knew that there was something out there that cared for me just a little bit more than I cared for myself, is the way I felt. And that's what I needed to start making the adjustment. And I said, okay, I will stay in AA, and I will keep this promise to you this time. I quickly got a sponsor. And I looked at my sponsor. He had 6 months sober. And some of you might know him, John Ross. And I looked at him. I said, you know what? You kind of got what I think that I want. But I don't know really what that is right now. But I need to go through the steps, because I know that I need to go through them. And he goes, I know that you've been in AA for a long time. He goes, I know you probably know the big book backwards and forwards. And you know all the things that I probably could tell you. He goes, but what we're going to do is we're going to look for that one piece that you keep missing every time. And he says, we're going to stay vigilant on that. And once we find that piece, I think that's what's going to change your life, so you can be sober for the rest of your life. And I say that because in the big book, it promises me that if I do the work and I have my daily reprieve and I stay connected with the higher power on a daily basis, I can be sober for the rest of my life. And it's totally contingent upon my willingness and the work that I do in Alcoholics Anonymous. I did this other kind of life coaching program once, and while we were going through the steps, and I almost walked out of that, and my sponsor, who was sponsoring me through this program, he goes, I was about to leave. I got mad at the lady that was trying to keep me there and be all dominatrix, like, you need to stay here, blah, 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 blah. And I looked at her, I said, I'm not talking to you, I'll speak to my sponsor. And I went in there, I said, I'm done. I don't care about anything anymore. I'm feeling hopeless again. And he goes, wait, I want you to stay here. And the reason why I want you to stay here, he goes, because nothing ensures ignorance other than contempt prior to investigation, that part in the spiritual experience. And I go, fuck. All right, so I'll stay. In the process of this program, there's a meditation exercise. And where y'all close your eyes. And there's a treasure chest that's in front of you. And they tell you, inside this treasure chest is the one thing that you've always wanted your entire life. The one thing that you've always wanted. And my egocentric and materialistic mind was, I want the BMWs, 750IL. I want the good job. I want to be famous. I want to have the really good-looking boyfriend that everybody goes, wow, he's such a trophy boyfriend, but he treated me really well. Those were the things that I thought I wanted more than anything else in my life. And I remember reaching into that that treasure chest, and I remember reaching down. There's a big ball of light in there. And I grabbed that ball of light and I brought it up to my chest. And I was fast forwarded to the end of my life. And I stood before my creator. And he said to me, welcome home, my good and faithful servant. And how dare you hate yourself when I created you in my image. And I found that missing piece. I found out that there was a God that loved me and that accepted me no matter what. And that I was made exactly the way I was for a reason. And I never questioned that ever again. And that was the one thing that I wanted more than anything else in the world, was to know that God loved me. I'm no longer afraid of God. I no longer try to prove his non-existence. I no longer have to worry about that. And when I had that experience, it was very, very easy for me to take that third step. Because see, the problem for me before was I never could do that third step because I didn't believe that there was a power greater than myself that truly loved me, that truly cared for me and wanted me to be anything more than what I was. Since then, I have not obsessed. The obsession at that moment was removed. And I want you guys to know that the only thing that could take that obsession away from me was God. There was nothing else that was going to do that. And I had tried for 12 years total. So that's what happened. And what it's like today, I try to live in the moment. I try to be of service to anybody in AA that asks. In the big book, you know, this is where I'm going to kind of get on my soapbox a little bit. In the first step, it talks about that we are powerless over alcohol and that our lives have become unmanageable. When we talk about that first step, the first thing that I had to realize is that what makes me an alcoholic is that I have the mental obsession. That I obsess about alcohol all the time. I'm thinking about any way that I can get my next drink. If that means that I'm going to blame Brittany because she looked at me funny one day, because Ryan won't sleep with me and be my boyfriend, because Chet won't love me the way I want him to love me, if I will use those, that's the mental obsession, I will use those excuses to find a reason to drink. The second part is if I succumb to the mental obsession and take that first drink, then I put myself into the place of the phenomenon of craving. That's the physical aspect, where my body will crave it, and I will do anything to get it. Doesn't mean that I have to be drinking daily or I have to be using drugs daily. It's not the amount. It's the lack of control. That I can't tell you every time I have a drink that I can just have one. So that's the twofold disease that I suffer from as an alcoholic, is I have the mental obsession and the phenomenon of craving, and that's it. Let me, by raise of hands, how many of you guys drank when you had a boyfriend or girlfriend? How many drank when you didn't? How many drank when you had a job? When you didn't have one? When you had money? When you didn't have, we could keep our hands up all the time, as you can see. So what that tells me is that it's not the circumstances that surround me or happen to me in life, why I drink. The reason why I drink is because I suffer from that twofold disease, period, end of story. Do those particular circumstances make it harder for me to stay sober sometimes? Yes. And can they affect me in a way that makes me want to drink? Yes. But are they the reason why I drink? No. I was taken advantage of while drunk. That's not why I drink. Yes, I'm adopted. That's not why I drink. And I drink to overcome an overwhelming desire that only exists in alcoholics, never in the temperate drinker. If you're more of a drug addict, one of the challenges I tell people, okay, switch the words from alcoholic to drug. And the funny thing about that is, once you start to realize that you're, even though you're substituting that word, if you're still relating to that same situation as it's described in the big book, wouldn't you be an alcoholic too? Just because you switched the word? I mean, alcoholism shows up in many forms for us. So I know a lot of people down here are heroin addicts is the big thing in Utah, and opiates and things like that. But if you suffer from the mental obsession, the phenomenon of craving, then that's what makes you one of us. Step two is coming to believe in a power greater than yourself. Obviously, I've told you what my experience with step two and three are, you guys. It's plain and simple. Nothing, and I've tried everything. Everything in the world, by you guys trying to utilize my sponsor as my to keep me sober. No human power is going to keep me sober. It must come from a power greater than myself, and it talks about that over and over and over in the big book. The fourth step is really important. It's called personal inventory, house cleaning. Anybody here worked in retail? How many of you had to go in on inventory night and fucking count all the little pieces of shit and pull the things that were wrong and discard them? That's what you're doing with your life. Here's an example. Do you remember those old 1980s station wagons? The big, huge metal station wagons? Okay, this is our lives. As alcoholics, we're driving in one of these cars, and as we're going through life, we're just creating wreckage, and we're just throwing everything in the back of that fucking car, in the back of that station wagon. When we get sober and we stop drinking and using, that's like hitting a brick wall, and all of that shit comes from the back and sitting up in the front of our laps. And what we get to do in the fourth step is we get to sift through that shit, we get to throw away the garbage, and we get to keep the things that actually belong in there. That's what the fourth step is about, is taking that personal inventory, finding all the things that are keeping your car dirty or keeping you sick. And then what you do is you're able to sift through that with another individual, hopefully a sponsor, and you go through that. And what they do is they sit down with you and they help you sift through that. And the best part about a fourth step is you get to finally start seeing your part in it. That was one of the beautiful things about what I realized in my fourth step. I used to resent every employer that fired me. I used to think, well, they fired me because they hate Asians or they hate gay people, which is completely bullshit, because in retail they love hiring gay people. And everybody trusts the Asians, but... but what I realized is all of a sudden when I started looking at my part, of course they fired me. I was sexually harassing an employee. Of course they fired me. I wasn't showing up to work on time. And I get to go through that and start separating those things and realizing why I did that. Now, the best part about the fifth step is once you do that, you get to move into 6 and 7. You get to determine what are the things in my life or the attributes. AA likes to call them character defects too. But what are those things that make me do those things? One of mine is ego. I'm the most egocentric, full of himself, think I know the best, and I'm always right. And the problem is that what's kept me sick? Because then all of a sudden I couldn't hear when somebody was telling me the truth because I thought I was the only person that was right. I got to start seeing those character defects that created each of those situations that caused that resentment or that caused that problem for me. And I get to have that in the 6 and 7 step, I get to find a way to release that and remove that from myself through the power of God, which I found in steps 2 and 3. And there's the beauty of that is I'm not rendered white as snow. I'm not. I still get to work on them every day. I'm an incredibly perverted person, as most of you know. But when it really comes down to another alcoholic needing help, my sobriety is not. It's the single most important thing in my life. I had the opportunity after doing my 6 and 7, which was the hardest one for me, and in the 12-1-12 it talks about it. It's where we separate the men from the boys, or the women from the girls. This is where I really get to take a very solid look at my life and what I am as a person and how I get to rid myself of these character defects that cause so much wreckage in my life. But the other thing is if you have a good sponsor, they're also going to go over your attributes list. You're going to talk about the things that are great about yourself because there's a lot of good things about every single one of us in this room. There's nothing that we've done in this world that is so horrible that it can't be righted or corrected or made amends for. And that's what 8 and 9 are for, is that we get to take that list from our 4th step and our character defects and all the people we have harmed, and we get to write that down. We get to write down their names, and we get to determine how we get to take care of those problems, that wreckage that we created. One of my amends that I did my 8th step with my sponsor, and goes, is there anybody on this list that you do not think you can possibly ever make an amends to? And I said, that guy right there. And he goes, why? I don't know where he lives. I haven't heard from him. I don't know where he's at. And he goes, well, are you willing to make that amends? I said, yes, I'm willing to make that amends. Go out to dinner with my friends to this randomly obscure place in San Diego that's like out in East County. So it's kind of like the white trash part of St. George, let's just put it that way. I don't know where that area is for you guys, but I'm Washington Fields. and I'm there, and I'm talking with my friends. They're like, so what do you guys do tonight? And because they're really interested about my 8, they're totally normies. I said, yeah, I did my 8th step, and list all the people. And as I'm telling them that, yeah, there's this one guy, I don't know how I'm going to get a hold of him, I'm sitting there, and right in front of me, the guy walks past me. I go, oh my God, this is not right. This can't be happening. And I start freaking out. I call my sponsor. He wasn't picking up the phone, so I call my other friend. Because he goes, you got to just do it. Just do it. And luckily for me, the way that this restaurant's set up, it's cook your own steak at the grill. So I'm looking at waiting for him to go cook his steak at the grill, and he finally walks up. So I walk up to him. I go, Jeffrey, I need to make an amends to you. Do you have some time? He goes, give me your phone number. I'll text you in a few minutes. And we go out, he finally texts me, we go outside to the smoking area, we smoke, and I make my amends. And I go, so why are you down here? He goes, well, I was putting together the Michael Jackson show up in LA, and then Michael Jackson died a couple nights ago, so we didn't know what, so they gave us all the time off. So Michael Jackson died so I can make that amends. But I was able to make that amends. And the funny thing is, you guys, is that when I became willing to make those amends and start setting those things right in my life, everything started to change. You know the 9th step promises that they read all the time? Things started to change for me like that. I didn't feel as lonely. I wasn't financially insecure when I started making my financial amends. Things started to fall in place, and the true blessings of this program started to happen for me. And I was like, it was really amazing. I was like, how does this happen? By me making things right, how does this happen? And, you know, I don't know the answer to that other than I did the work. Now, I'm going to zip backwards a little bit before I do 10, 11, and 12. In the portion of chapter 5, how it works. There's a portion in there where it talks about if you want what we have. So if you're new or you're struggling with this program and you're trying to stay sober, I want you to ask yourself this question. What is it that we have that you want? If you don't know that question or an answer to that question, go up and talk to somebody that you hear say something in a meeting that touches you at your heart and ask them, hey, how did you get that sense of peace? How did you get that sense of self-love again? Because see, one of the things that I found out that I wanted more than anything else in the world is I wanted to feel like I belonged to someone, somewhere, that I was loved, to have self-acceptance, self-love, and those are the things that I wanted more than anything else in the world, and that's what I learned, that I wanted those things. Now, the funny thing is the next caveat to that is, if you want what we have, then the next question and is willing to go to any lengths to get it. And see, if you don't know what it is that we have that you want, you're not going to be able to make that next part. You're not going to be able to answer that and do anything that it takes. Be willing to go to any lengths to get it. So you have to ask yourself that question and find out what it is. Really get down on your knees, talk to other alcoholics and ask them, what is it that you have that I should want? Or find those questions out. Because once you find that out, you're willing to go to any lengths to get it. Guess what? The rest of the program is easy, because the next part of that question is, then you are ready to take certain steps. You see, I've never found a place where I feel like I belong more than I do in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I met Steve, a little over a year and a half ago. Originally, it was at Wacky Pod Mid-Year Summit, and he was Q. And that's initially what drove me to him. And the funny thing is what Steve doesn't realize is what I saw Steve doing that night in grabbing a newcomer guy that couldn't stay sober and inviting him back to his hotel room and sitting down with him with the big book. That's what made Steve even more attractive, because all of a sudden I saw what this program is all about. It's about grabbing that newcomer and grabbing the guy that's still sick and saying, hey man, let us spend some time with you. And ever since that moment, we came up to his house after that and he let us stay there and he showed us wonderful hospitality. We had a lot of fun. We started talking about the idea of Stucky Paw and, you know, getting him excited. We talked about some people and then I said, well, you know what, do it. And then I left and I didn't see him till 6 months later at Wacky Paw. And after Wacky Paw, they're all, yeah, we're going to do it. We're going to get Stucky Paw set up. And look at it now, you guys. A young people's committee has blossomed in St. George. You guys have a place to get together and be of service to each other and grow a fellowship that didn't exist before. And you see all these people getting sober. So give yourselves a hand. I've been sober since January 30th of 2010. If that kind of gives you, the first time was 2001, so that kind of gives you an idea of what this disease is like. Today, I have a job that I can show up to. I show up to on time majority of the time. I'm responsible. And I'm of service. I helped get started the Salty Paw, which is the Salt Lake Territory Young People's Alcoholics Anonymous. And last year we bid for Wacky Paw for the first time. And we came there with power and strength. and touch people's lives. And that's what the beauty of service is. If you're not on Stucky Paw, get on Stucky Paw. Because that's a big part of it. We work the 12 steps, which is for ourselves at the first. But then we get into service. We join those committees. We chair a meeting. We give a ride to the newcomer that doesn't know how to get to a meeting because he doesn't have a car. And then the other thing I want to talk about, and it just kind of is 10 and 11, is about 10 for me is basically 1 through 9 on a daily basis. So I take a look at my day, I see where I need to make amends, where I was wrong, and I make them immediately. And I say, you know what, I fucked up, I did something wrong. The way I do my amends is I go up to the individual and I say, you know, this is what I did. What I did was wrong. And I want to ask you what I need to do to make that situation right. I don't apologize because for Wade, I was always sorry. I was always sorry, but I never meant it. So my amends process is asking them what I get to do to make that situation right. And sometimes they say nothing, and they say, you know what you're doing is fine. Sometimes they say, well, give us some money. And sometimes they'll shut the door in your face and say, I don't ever want to see you again. But see, for me, making the amends process is trying to set right all the wrongs that I've done. I had to go to a porno shop where I had to pay for a whole bunch of shit that I'd stolen from that store. And if you could have looked at the faces of the things that I brought up to the front and said, I have to make an amends for some things I stole here from you. It was classic. It was an epic moment. I had to go to an employer and return money that I had stolen from them, fully expecting to go to jail. And what's funny is after I made that amends, he goes, so do I need to call your sponsor and let him know you made this amends? And I go, no, he's standing right over there. And I'm just going to close with the 12th step, because this is the most important step for an alcoholic after you've worked the other 11. In the big book, it talks about nothing will ensure immunity from the next drink as intensive work with another alcoholic. And also talks about that we, as having had a spiritual awakening as a result of working the steps, we tried to carry this message to other alcoholics and practice these principles in all of our affairs. What that means to me, you guys, is that I don't sit on my lofty, I've completed the 12 steps and wait for the newcomer to come up and talk to me. That means I get my lazy ass off that fucking chair and I go up to that new guy and I say, hey man, I don't recognize you. My name is Wade. What's your name? That means that I carry the message. That means I do the work to help get them started on this journey that was so freely given to me. That means I get to be that guy that said hello to me at my first meeting. That means that I get to call my sponsees when I haven't heard from them in a while and say, hey, I haven't heard from you in a while. How you doing? That means that I get to go out and be of service. That means that I take the time out of my busy day that I have been given as a result of working these steps and this life that God has given back to me. I get to take that time back out and I get to go help another guy out. I get to sponsor women because I'm gay. And can I tell you, women are the funnest people to sponsor in the world. Sorry guys, but it's really kind of cool. But the beautiful part about sponsoring people, and this is where the real miracle happens, is when you're sitting down with a newcomer guy or one of your sponsees, and when you see in their eye that they finally get it, that light comes on in their eye and they finally get it, and they get, you see that sense of feeling that I can stay sober, I can do this thing, and that despair and that hopelessness that they've had for so many years disappears, and you see that first glimmer of hope. That's the power of this program. If you've just stopped at 12 and you're not working with another alcoholic, you're not only cheating yourself out of the true miracle of this program, but you're cheating another person out of the blessings of this program. I make it a responsibility of myself that every time I go to a meeting, I try to introduce myself to at least someone I don't know. And I give them my number. This disease kills. I'm sure every one of us has known somebody that has died from this disease. Some of us die, so the rest of us can live. Some of us are the beautiful blessing to show us how serious this disease is. But the funny thing is that death and fear aren't going to be enough to keep you sober. I can't scare you into sobriety. What I can offer you is hope. And I can offer you a way of life that I promise you, if you do the 12 steps and start working with another alcoholic, you will have a life beyond your imagination. The most beautiful things in your life will happen in sobriety. See, I used to believe there was good and bad. Today, I don't believe that. Today, I believe that there's news and good news. Because if there's a situation that I might consider bad, if I've learned a lesson from that, then it's a good thing. And that includes my relapses. That includes the death of my friends. That includes the resentments. Because all of those things I've learned something from. And today I learn from my mistakes, so I don't make as many of them anymore. Again, if you're new, my name is Wade. My phone number is 801-245-0558. If you don't have a sponsor, there's a lot of good guys and a lot of good girls down here that you can get their number that I know are willing to take you through the steps, that are eager. This program will change your life. You'll finally have that peace of mind and that self-worth that you've always wanted your entire life. I look in the mirror today and I don't see a gay Asian man anymore. I see a beautiful man. An instrument for my higher power. And I love myself today. I've never loved myself before. And I love myself today. I used to be afraid of all of you straight guys. Because how you would judge me. Because see, I couldn't be okay with myself unless everybody in this room could be comfortable and accept me. I couldn't do that. Today, because of my experiences in this program, I don't care what you think of me. Because I know what I think of myself. And what I find now is that most of the guys in this room are much more afraid of me than I am of them. Thank you, Stucky Paw, for doing what you do. Thank you for continuing that fire. Thank you for becoming what you've become. And how you've grown this group of friends, this family down here, is pretty damn amazing. A lot of people up in Salt Lake are very envious of the camaraderie and the closeness that you guys have. You guys stick together like glue, and it's noticeable, and it's felt. That's why I come down here every month, because I miss you guys, and I love you guys, and I love the energy that you have, and the enthusiasm that you have for this program and for staying sober. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to share a little bit of my life and my story with you, and thank you for keeping me sober another day. And with that, I'll take another 24. Oh!